Welcome to Scrappy ABM, your source for groundbreaking approaches that don't break the bank. ABM shouldn't cost $200K in tech to even get started. So if you want to get started with ABM or make your program even better without investing a massive amount of money, you're in the right place. Each week, we'll hear from the brightest minds in the marketing world who are redefining ABM, achieving incredible results with untraditional methods, limited resources, and a whole lot of creativity. This isn't a show about how much money you can spend on fancy tech or overhyped tools. Instead, it's about celebrating creative problem solving and the scrappiness it takes to get ABM right. We'll dive into how these marketing leaders built robust ABM strategies with limited resources, revealing the actionable insights that led to their biggest wins. So if you're a marketer ready to challenge the status quo and build a scalable, efficient, effective marketing strategy, Scrappy ABM is the show for you. So if you're ready to discover ABM strategies that are lean, impactful, and utterly transformative, let's dive into this episode.
All right, dude, before we get into meat and potatoes, why don't you tell the people, all the millions and millions of people about you, who you are?
Yeah, founder of a company called Scrappy ABM. We're the only ABM service provider that delivers step-by-step programs for the crawl stage of account-based marketing, which just simply means if you actually want to get started in a way that is highly likely to succeed, we are the only option that actually focuses on that space in a dedicated way. So that's where we live. That's all we do is build ABM programs. And the other unique, I think, that's helpful for people to understand is we frame ourselves as an ABM enablement organization. So we're going to build a program for you, provide all the SOPs and enablement documentation, train you on how the program was built and the frameworks, and then send you on your way. So generally, you work with us for 12 months, and then you can go build scaled programs. So that's the thought process.
That's awesome. And it didn't occur to me before this, but who are you for, right? So if I go to a business and they've got a person and that person's title is ABM something or other, right? Is it for them, or is it the VP of marketing at, like, you know, the company doing 5-10 million in revenue, and they're like, we got to get this ABM thing moving and grooving? Like, who do you guys work with the most?
Yeah, it's a great question. The answer is generally it depends on the context of the situation. So when you look at the career path for many ABM managers, they started as SDRs that were then plucked out of the sales org and then said, hey, you're going to run ABM for our marketing team. So they know a lot about the sales side of ABM. They know nothing about the marketing side of ABM. So in that context, we're generally actually supporting the ABM manager in more of the strategic orchestration. And I mean that's very kindly, but a lot of ABM managers, again, were SDRs. And then when they turn into that ABM manager, they actually become more of like an ABM project manager and not a program manager. So they manage the ideas that all get thrown at them. And then they end up doing that for about a year. The program fails and they get laid off. Sorry to put it that bluntly, but like, that's just what's happened a lot. So there's one, and we're brought in to support the ABM managers. If they don't have an ABM background, and I want to give context because some people may be listening into this. And I think I'm thinking of a couple of ABM managers, and like one of them works at Gong. That's not their path, and that's okay. But it's a generalization that we've seen a lot. So not everybody that's an ABM manager follows the path that I just said, but I've seen it a lot. So that's one place in which we support. And the idea is you tried to build ABM on your own. It didn't work, or it didn't work as much as you would have liked it to. We come in to support back at right foundations and then build the program, for lack of a word, correctly in the first place. So that's one. The other option that we've seen a lot would be people that are exploring ABM for the first time or new. There's been a lot of new VPs and CMOs that have been hired at some earlier stage companies or some organizations that are ready for modernized marketing, and they've been tasked with building ABM. So they then bring us in as their essentially ABM team to get the program running that they will then manage. So again, contextually, if you're a larger organization with an ABM manager, we sometimes work with those unless they have great ABM experience, at which point, admittedly, you don't need us. Or it's a VP of marketing that's exploring ABM for the first time or has been recently hired to build ABM and just needs some extra support to strategically build out the program.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a ton of sense. You are so passionate about this subject matter, and that has to come from somewhere. And, you know, like people say, oh, B2B marketing, and which means bazillion different things. And then here you are, you've said, no, like, yes, but ABM. And so why are you in ABM? Why did you start Scrappy ABM specifically?
A couple of core things. One, my first job was actually as a full funnel AE selling print advertising, which people are like, really? Where's the connection to the tech space? I'll get there. I was given the list as a seller, and I was told, call down your list. And I had 600 names, and that list would change out every quarter. And that was how I started my career. And again, in that context, what I think was the kicker for me, that was a realization, is I was full funnel, cradle to grave, AE plus account manager. So once the deal was closed, I still managed the relationship. And also, because we're a media company, the founder said, we don't really need any marketing because we're a marketing vehicle. Well, who was enjoying the programming that we were producing was different from the buyers. So as a result, my first job was straight commission, just figure it out, was essentially what happened, which was fine. Because I ended up closing like $500,000 in about a year, because about 3 or 4 months in, what I realized after essentially, because I've also gotten really, really good at talking fast, succinct, and like clearly, I realized when I called somebody and I just word vomited at them in an impressive amount of words in a very short period of time, I would see probably 1% of people book a meeting. So about 4 months in, I stopped just word vomiting features and benefits at people. But I said, hey, I'm calling you and you're on my list, but here's why. Like, here's the benefit that I see uniquely for your organization. And I looked at some things. Doesn't look like you're doing anything in this space. And I get why. It's weird because we were a parenting magazine. So I'd call, like, for example, one was a nursing home. So it was like a home healthcare system. And I was like, it's weird for you to think, why would I advertise in a parenting magazine? But if you think about it, it looks like your persona is like mom Martha. And you're looking for the 35 to 45 year old moms that are having aging parents that need to think through home care solutions for their parents. Well, 93% of our audience is that exactly. This is the number of impressions that you're going to get to this exact audience. And because it's print, so again, it wasn't just feature dump. It was like personalized to that account. I didn't know that when I started that, but that's ABM. And what I love about ABM is when done incredibly well, it makes everyone in the organization more successful. I also really like just in general, helping people and making them better at their jobs. So when you do ABM well, you actually create sellers that enjoy cold calling or enjoy outbounding because they know that there's an intentional strategic reason and an actual value for the person on the other end, which is why when ABM is done well, you see higher deal values and accelerated pipeline because everybody from the onset actually understands the value. And then what ends up happening is when you do ABM well, you see an increase in lifetime value and customer satisfaction because they were the right fit at the beginning, which means you actually create a better situation for your customer success teams that are managing the accounts for a long time. So I love ABM because when done well, everybody actually wins. Like marketing wins because they're viewed as a strategic partner versus an arts and crafts department. Sales wins because you are actually engaging right fit customers that actually need your stuff and need it now. Customer success wins because they get customers that actually value them. And then most importantly, the customer wins because it's actually a product or a service that is strategically matched to where they are and what they need. And you actually help them and you don't just take cash and generate no return. You actually help them in the long term. So that's why I love ABM. It's a way longer answer than you're probably expecting, but like I started with, let me just call down my list. And like, if I get something, I'm happy. And after a year, I actually became friends with my target accounts and they saw value in me as a partner and they cared about me and I cared about them. And that's crazy. But like, I feel like that's the root of why ABM is so effective and impactful when done well.
Yeah, I think that that's just so remarkably critical. I mean, you think about when marketing teams and sales enablement orgs and all these folks are talking about personalization or whatever they want to call it. And it's really just this real mandate towards relevance. And it's wild to me how rarely when you get a pitch that is relevant, right? It's just this, hey, we've got a thing and you should buy it. Also, you haven't responded to my email where I asked you to buy my thing. Were you going to respond to my email or were you going to be a real jerk about not buying my thing? I'm definitely not buying. I don't even know what your thing is. I don't even know what you're talking about, right? And I definitely don't know why I care. Right, the lack of context is so unbelievable, and I think that that's the piece around ABM where, and I don't know if I'm going to piss anybody off. Actually, hopefully I do. I think one of the issues here with ABM that I think is really interesting is that I think ABM is how the entire revenue funnel and all functions of the revenue funnel should be working at all times. I don't think the way that you describe ABM is the way that marketing should work, period. Right? I don't think it's a program. I think it's a mindset, right? And I from my experience is that when people talk about ABM, they're like, oh, ABM is one of a range of strategies that we employ here. And because of what a great job we do on our ABM motion, we can only do that with 100 accounts a quarter or whatever their number is. And it's like, what you just told me is that you're only capable of world-class revenue efforts for 100 accounts a quarter, and that everything else is kind of like spaghetti against the wall bullshit. I mean, pardon me, but like that's kind of how it feels.
I'm trying to find the episode. There's an episode titled in the Scrappy ABM podcast, literally like ABM is a mindset, not a strategy. Because, and there's two thoughts here. One, everything you're outlining was actually directly, essentially from, I don't know if you're familiar with Sangram Verghese. In my mind, he's the godfather of account-based marketing. Author a book back in 2016 that is called ABM is B2B. So like good B2B marketing, and even Latney at Sixth Sense has said like ABM is actually just really good B2B marketing. So like what's sometimes frustrating is that this concept shouldn't be that revolutionary. Like to put it really bluntly, it's like figure out what problems you actually solve for who and care about them. Like care about actually solving the problem for them. And if you like, and I'll this is gonna sound odd for me to say. We had engaged a client and we went with the playbook, and I wasn't super like it wasn't the playbook that I was like, I don't know that this is going to crush it, but they wanted to do it. We agreed to it. We built it, and they got zero results, like fundamentally zero results. So I refunded them because like
Oy.
I don't care that we did
Wow.
the work, but like I care about the customer. And you know, they hopped on the call and I think they were really hesitant to tell us like this really didn't get anything. And I said, what do you mean this didn't get anything? Like I was more upset about it than they were, because at the end of the day, I made a promise to them as a brand, we'll generate some results for you. If I don't generate any results, then I didn't deliver on my brand promise. And as a result, you just shouldn't have to pay. But like, that's not universally accepted. Like, like we'd all come to some excuse around, oh, they didn't do the process. They didn't implement the program. They didn't do XYZ things. It's like, but is that their fault? Like maybe as a brand, we should take ownership that maybe our onboarding process wasn't effective. Maybe we sold them the wrong solution. Maybe we shouldn't have sold them in the first place. Like let's take some learnings as a brand, refine our ICP, not penalize them for us getting to learn something, and then actually go after a different audience that's going to get the results that we want.
Man, it's interesting. There's a post this week on LinkedIn that I really appreciated. And this guy is running marketing over for copy.ai. He's been working kind of as an SDR AE on a small set of opportunities, basically to exploit their own product and really use it and get first, you know, firsthand, like frontline knowledge of how it works. And I love it. I love what he's doing. And he had this interesting post about how someone had come back to him. His thesis really is these tools, these generative AI tools are great as a way to accelerate, you know, the strength and capacity of an SDR. And this buyer was saying, I want to fully automate my outbound. And he said, I disagree. It's not going to work that well, right? It just can't, it really can't. There's got to be a human in the loop here, and it's an SDR, and this is how they use it with it. And then at the end, you know, and so he gets through the call, and all of like 8 minutes was the post. And he said, so agree to disagree, best of luck. Right. And I really love that. And I love that for a couple of reasons. And I think it speaks also to where you're at, right? Cause you've been talking a lot on LinkedIn too, about where you are in revenue and growth, and you guys are really kicking a bunch of ass this year, which is incredible. Kudos on that. But you see that and you go, when you enable sellers and marketing organizations with world-class product, you get to be picky and specific and recognize that things didn't go well or that opportunities don't look right. Right. Cause back to your point before about the entire nature of ABM, which is really the entire nature of revenue. If we get the right people who want to do the things that we do the right way that we do them, everything gets better. We retain them. They spend more. They make referrals, right? They're easy to work with, right? But when you set yourselves up with those customers, we're like, yeah, they're about to write me a pretty decent check. But boy, God, this just feels crappy, right? I don't know that I want to do this. But you do it because there's a check there. You take that check a lot of times because you're just not sure you're going to get to see another one very soon, because you don't feel great about product. And I think that's a really interesting piece of the puzzle too, is, you know, if you don't feel good about what you're selling, I think everything else really starts to come into question and starts to explain why good marketers and good salespeople make dumb decisions, right? Is because they're just desperate for the cash.
Yeah. And on that point, it used to frustrate me to no end, the idea and the statement of, you know, you should work and market and sell a product that you believe in. Because admittedly, again, I was selling print advertising. So I was like, I don't know how valuable this actually is, to be entirely like I thought it was. But like, there was no real tracking around it. I was just kind of trusting our team and our audits. But then I transitioned. I'm a big Dave Ramsey fanatic. So I hate debt. And my second job, where I was a marketing leader, was a lending software company. And I hated myself because I was actively promoting a product. And I went through the interview process. There were some things, and this is well documented in other places, so I won't dig in too much. But like, at the end of the day, it was just like, this is fundamentally against what I believe. And until you've actually worked in an organization in which you truly believe in the product and you know that it's an actually beneficial thing, a lot of what we're talking through sounds foreign. And often most SDRs, their first job, they literally don't know. And I don't mean that as an insult to anybody, but like, I didn't know what I didn't know in my first job. Right. So like, once you've actually worked in an organization in which you can believe in the product, you literally cannot go back, because everything is exponentially better when clearly the people that work on it believe in it, which is why when I talk about ABM in this way and the benefits that come from this approach to ABM, it is still foreign to some people because they haven't worked on a product. And I hate to put it this way, but they haven't worked on a product that actually truly benefits people that much, because a lot of products currently are being venture backed or PE backed because they're nice to have and they're good ideas in theory, but they haven't been validated through product market fit, which is why I think that ABM is exclusively a strategy that is for product market fit, because you know that the product specifically is designed for this audience. Otherwise, it's very difficult to establish a program around ABM, because you're still just guessing if this is a viable solution for this audience.
And then you have no substrate upon which to build relevancy and context for the buyer, right? I'm so with you. It's really interesting. It's almost as if like an ABM capacity audit would be one of the most amazing things for like an A and B round venture firm to run on a prospective investment in the B2B or enterprise software spaces. It's like, if these guys couldn't run an ABM play, there's nothing here, right? Like, yeah, we gotta run. We can't write a check to these guys. I don't know that I've ever thought of it that way, but dude, that's pretty remarkable. Okay, so within the ABM programs that are working, right, company's got great product. What are the keys to you? What are the hallmarks of a phenomenal ABM program? And I think more, you know, kind of frameworks is how everybody kind of is best tuned to approaching this stuff, because the nuances obviously look different every single time, I'm sure. But it's like, what's the framework of a great ABM program?
Yeah, so we've got a framework that we've been developing, and I think it's pretty simple to outline. There's two components to any ABM program. So the first is what we refer to as our account progression model. I think of the account progression model as the strategy. So the strategy is, who are we going after? And then how do we progress them from them knowing that we exist into acquisition, and then inevitably expansion? And we think about these in kind of three general buckets. So your first bucket is prospecting, your second bucket is opportunities, your third bucket would be customers. I think those are three distinct, unique programs because there's different goals and objectives. It's like, to bring someone that doesn't know that you exist into pipeline, like, that's not a small lift. And admittedly, you're often going after a specific champion, and the goal is to raise awareness within the rest of the buying committee. Whereas when you're in pipeline, the goal is actually to get all the different decision makers in the room with you to the best of your ability, and focused a lot on what it's been often referred to as buyer enablement. It's like, prime example, I often have a CFO as a blocker. I've talked to 5 CFOs in 200 deals in the past year. So often I have to give the buyer enablement to my buyer to prove it to their CFO. And that's all in pipeline things that are very specific to the context of that deal. And then lastly, you've got the customer side, which is, okay, like, especially in services businesses, like, I am, and be clear for any clients that are listening, I don't do this always. Sometimes I do. I have access to your data. Like, I have access to your HubSpot. I can actually viably see all of your problems. Like, in a way that I can't in prospect world. Like, in prospect world, forgive me for putting it this way, you're often, like, educated guessing at the challenges until they tell you these are challenges that we're experiencing. And there's lots of signals and there's trends that you can identify within your data. But it's educated guessing. When you're in the customer's data in platforms, you know. Like, you know what the challenge is. So you can easily build expansion programs on your customers because you have more access to data. So again, the strategy is the account progression model based in one of those three buckets. And then out of that, you have what we refer to as our activation playbooks. So our activation playbooks are the tactics of what you do to move an account from one stage to the next. So for quick context, in prospecting, it would be things like awareness, initial engagement, meaningful engagement, marketing qualified account, re-engagement, SQA, and SQA stands for sales qualified account, and then it's an opportunity. So that would be a prospecting program. And then you and your organization get to define what awareness is. For Scrappy ABM, generally awareness for us is like, they follow me on LinkedIn to resource most of our opportunities. So if they are following me on LinkedIn, they are aware that we exist, and that was the goal. Great. Initial engagement is likely something to the extent of, like, they've hit our website. Great. They've hit our website. Meaningful engagement could be things like, they've been on the podcast, they've messaged me on LinkedIn. Like, there are lots of meaningful engagement programming that we can do. But the primary goal, and another thing in the context of my website, for example, there we go. I have a one-page website right now. So, like, if they've spent significant time on page versus just, like, they hit the page and they bounce, that could be meaningful engagement. Again, you get to define it for yourself. Re-engagement is then me intentionally reaching out and saying, hey, wanted to see if you were interested in building an ABM program or whatever that messaging needs to look like. Really more tactful than that, but that's it. And then they schedule a call and I qualify them, and then they turn into an opportunity. So that's it. Opportunity, your stages would likely just follow your sales process. And you have different playbooks at every single stage to accelerate the pipeline. And this is the way that I would think through it of, we had a client in which they constantly were stopped by the IT team. They had zero content that spoke to IT teams, and only 40% of their deals involved IT. I was like, well, that's a problem. Mm. So how are we intentionally and specifically proactively engaging the IT team into the deal and creating content that speaks to their challenges? And at what stage should we do that? That's a playbook.
Yeah.
And then lastly, the customer expansion side would be, like, the core is, do they get initial time to value with the initial product? And can you validate that what you did worked for them? And then there is at some point a re-diagnostic phase that then identifies more challenges that you can solve for them. And this does not have to be like a super deep dive. Sometimes it's just like a question on your onboarding process. We've got a client we're about to start working with that offers like hardware and software, and they have like their own facility to develop parts for, I'm not going to give too many details, but that's like, you can buy hardware, develop parts. They have a manufacturing facility that will develop your parts, and they have software to design the parts. So often everybody's buying software. And then in their onboarding process, they're asking, how are you developing your parts that you design? And they may or may not have an answer. And if they have an answer, they're like, oh, we've already got the equipment. It's like, awesome. Good to know. And then you can check in 9 months later and say, hey, how's your equipment holding up? Do you need any new equipment to match some of the more complex parts that you're developing? Whatever that needs to look like. The other side is, they may say, we have an outsourced partner that's designing all and developing all of our parts. Great. We can do that for you. And actually, because we're all doing it in one bundle, we can get some economies of scale. Would that be of interest? Or, man, based on the volume that you're producing, you would actually save money by buying your own hardware. And now, like, all of those are just expansion things. There's a diagnostic that has to happen somewhere once the customer has become a customer. So, again, you build all those things out, and your activation playbook is very simple. At every single stage, you ask four questions. So, one, data. Who are we going after? Why are we reaching out? So, again, who is it? What's the reason we're talking to them? Talk about customers again. They just bought software. They may need hardware. That's who it is. That's why we're reaching out. Next would be distribution channels. So what are we going to use to get in front of these people? Could be email, could be LinkedIn, could be podcast. I mean, it could be any number of things, but how are we getting in front of these people? Next would be destination. So it's the content we're going to send to them that educates them on what they would need from us. And then lastly is direction. How are we tracking it? How do we know that they are engaging and doing the action that it was intended to be the action? And if you want to get kind of the, I think I've got a buddy that calls this like a ninja move. The ninja move, when you actually go to build an ABM program, is in one playbook at the awareness stage. The direction piece is in the trigger on the data piece for the initial engagement stage, one stage down. And that's how you connect all your playbooks to then actually progress an account from one stage to the next.
Super cool. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you've mentioned, you mentioned content a couple of times is, you know, destinations, right? To kind of keep moving people through. What's the process? Well, I'll take a step back. What is content's role kind of generally in ABM? And then also, you know, how do you know what those content destinations need to be, right? How do you know what to create, and then how do you get them there?
Yeah, a couple of great questions here. First, you know, when I think through the 4D framework, which again is like the tactical, what do you go and do? You have the data piece, which is not content. You have distribution, which is channels, but all of your channels are also content. So when you think about it, like,
totally,
what is the ad copy that you're going to write? What are the email sequences that you're going to write? So when we think through content, there's a part of this in all of our ABM programs where, like, content's actually 50% of the four buckets in a lot of ways. So again, there is the, what are we sending them to? But like, how do we create engaging content in feed or in email or whatever it is that actually gets them to click through? So that's the first thought process around content is, what are we saying that gets them to engage in longer form content? And the considerations on that front would just be, for distribution, like, where your audience is actually living. And then given the sender, or you could think about it as sender, but like given the distribution mechanism, where are they most likely to engage? So again, where are they living and where are they actually likely to engage? Everybody lives in their inbox. If you are completely cold, it is unlikely you will engage there. What I have found is, and I was just talking on another podcast with a SVP of marketing that sells into sales leaders. For right fit target accounts that are already showing significant engagement, she will connect with them and send them a message and like start a conversation and just do a networking call and like essentially, for lack of a word, like hang out with other leaders. And it's just peer to peer. And then generally speaking, what has consistently happened is they'll mention some challenges that they're solving or trying to solve for. And she'll go, I should definitely connect you with one of our AEs. And like, I'd love to be on that first call and just like strategize with you. And like, that's how they've generated a lot of pipeline. So the distribution channel was LinkedIn messages, but the sender was specific to the audience. So that's the core piece. And then from there, destination. I think about this a lot in two components. We often talk about like content message. I don't know that we talk enough about content mediums, because depending on who your audience is, they may engage in podcasts, they may engage in blog content, they may engage in a newsletter, they may engage in YouTube videos. I learned a ton through YouTube. And like, it's not just what are we saying and what's the message, but it's how is it delivered. Specifically in the context of a lot of our client relationships, I've had a team member that started to say a lot, what you say is just as important as how you say it. And I think that's a very wise piece of advice for just all content marketers, because if you say the perfect message in a medium that nobody engages with in your audience, then you didn't say the perfect message. Like, nobody's read it. So those are the considerations. Final thought here is I find it somewhat humorous sometimes. I've talked with a ton of clients that are like, yeah, we're going to stop doing our SEO strategy because it's not working as well. And we're really leaning heavily into a thought leadership strategy. And I'm like,
okay.
And they're like, so we're going to have our SDRs create thought leadership. I'm like, no, you're not. Because to have a thought leadership, you have to have original thoughts. And that's not to be offensive, but like, again, when I was essentially an AE functioning as my own BDR, I didn't have leading thoughts on parenting or business. I was a college graduate that was single. So to for my bosses to come to me and say, I need you to be a thought leader on parenting is offensive. Like, it's just so
you're a lunatic. Are you telling me I need to go have children to do my job? So, I don't know what I'm talking about.
So that said, when you think through destination content, like, you have to have content that is actually engaging, that is actually leading in its thoughts. And that often comes through an SME. So, and I think through how to structure the content, because the content should also match to the account progression model, like your awareness and initial engagement stage. It should be thinking through how to think, and it should be talking through how to think. So a lot of my content, I'm just talking like a different way to think about ABM. And I'm literally trying to re-educate people on how to even think about the concept. That's 80% of what I do. When I create content, it's just re-education on a thought process. And then at your meaningful engagement, you've now, they are problem aware. At meaningful engagement, they are solution aware that you are a viable solution potentially. So when you go to re-engagement, you should change from like, how should you think about this topic given your context, to now more specifically, these are ways in which we could partner to help you implement this new thought process. So that could be things around use case content, case studies, testimonials. Like, all of this is intended because, again, at meaningful engagement, they should already be like product or solution or service aware. Now this is validating the use case in their context. So again, how are you need to do that? That could be a video. It could be a long white paper. It could be any number of things. But how are they actually going to engage in that message? So again, that was a lot on content, but like, that's how you should be thinking through it.
Yeah, I really, I like the entire framework. And I think, you know, I look, I mean, there's SDRs out there who, I mean, there's this one guy, Brian LaManna, who works for Gong, right? And he's a world-class subject matter expert, but he's a SDR for a company that enables SDRs with technology that's great for SDRs, right? And it's like, so it makes sense, right? He's a you know, kind of evangelist practitioner type of role, and it makes sense. But for the most part, right, you hire in an SDR, and even an AE, right? It's you know, I've said this a million times over the years, and I've hired enough salespeople. You hire for the sales skill set. You don't hire for the subject matter knowledge, right? You hire for the sales skill set. You don't hire for the Rolodex, which it used to be that hiring for the Rolodex is actually interesting. And then, you know, between ZoomInfo and Apollo and everybody else, it's like, no. Nobody's got a Rolodex anymore. That game's over, right? Contacts are easy to get to. So the thing really becomes about enabling those people. And it's so interesting. I'm just, you know, for anybody tuning in and curious about how to enable those subject matter experts within the business, you know, I hear a lot, I'm sure you've run into it too. It's like, ugh, I can't get Jenny to sit down and write a blog post, or I can't get Tom to, like, you know, put a good LinkedIn post up or whatever it is. And the thing that I think is really incredible, and you talked about the medium, right? And ages ago, people used to talk about how the medium is the message, right? That, you know, so this sentiment that, like, a video or the fact that it's YouTube or it's a podcast or it's blog post is, like, part of the entire concept of how content really needs to behave and perform. So repurposing is a huge deal. I love some of the things that, like, Tofu is doing around the, like, content repurposing, and I think is very clever, right? I love that kind of playbook approach to content items. But the thing that I think is so interesting now with these mediums and these opportunities is, here we are, and yeah, sure, we're going to spend a full, whatever, 40 minutes together here on this podcast, but coming out of this, I'm going to hand this over to our head of marketing, and we're going to chop it up, but inside of this thing, there's probably 5 blog posts and 10 to 15 LinkedIn posts worth of content, and I could just get a SME to sit down with me and just put them on a Zoom recording on an internal call. I work in content or in marketing. Hey, Jenny, can you spend 15 minutes with me? This topic right here is a big deal for our audience. I just want you to rip, and I'll keep prodding you for the next 10 or 15. Don't worry about it. I'll get the transcript. Yep. I'll turn that into something phenomenal. You can then go put it out there whenever you feel like it. But all I need in total from you is maybe 20 minutes of time. And we've nailed the week, right? We've nailed the week. And I think it's just one of those things where I think enabling marketing teams to extract this subject matter expertise then is I mean, that's the anchor to everything else from my perspective. And I think it is not as hard as people think it is, but I think the way we're asking makes it feel hard to the executives and subject matter experts that we want that stuff to come from.
Yeah. Here are 3 very practical ways to actually pull out subject matter expertise. One that you just outlined is just, hey, let's sit down for 20 minutes. What I did when I worked at that lending software company, there were a lot of really, really smart people that knew their stuff on their specific area. So what I did, instead of making it a burden for one person and saying, like, I need your time every week, I was like, hey, we've got 8 SMEs internally that are going to talk through their area of expertise, and I need 20 minutes once every 8 weeks. And people are like, I can do that. You're talking like 2 hours a year to fuel our entire content program? Yeah, I can do that. Like, so if you have a lot of SMEs, don't make it one person. Because it's easy to go to the founder and say, hey, founder, you're the evangelist or whatever. No, like, even on our team, we have a small team. We're like 8 people strong, but like I am in the process of setting it up to where our content expert can showcase all of his expertise on content. Our operations expert can showcase all of his expertise on operations. So like, it doesn't have to be one person. And like, if you want a really great example of this scaled up, it's weird to think about, but I love the model. It's the Dave Ramsey model of thought leadership, because Dave Ramsey, for anybody that doesn't know, I've already referenced him once. He's a financial guru that like talks about a bunch of financial stuff. Under him, he's got a guy on mental health, a guy on careers, a gal on families, a guy that's like all focused on kind of the new generation that's coming up. Someone that's focused on college and college debt. So he's got then a bench of like eight other thought leaders. And in their context, they're a $600 million a year organization. So they're pretty big. And they started to measure like what is revenue that's generated that's not specific to this one person, and it's Dave. 78% of the revenue has nothing to do with Dave Ramsey anymore, even though he founded it 30 years ago. So again, there's two sides to this. If you're a marketer thinking through, how do I get buy-in to do this? One, again, if you have a lot of SMEs, like you can spread the love on that. And even if you're in a small organization, especially if you're in a small organization, you have to have hired smart people to scale. You hire talent when you're really small that doesn't need as much structure and process. So they're probably really smart. Like I have to assume so. So you can start there. And then inevitably what actually happens, and this is what Scrappy ABM will do over time. Scrappy ABM right now is synonymous with Mason Cosby, but I'm building up individual thought leaders for their practice areas so that the brand that is Scrappy ABM is larger than Mason Cosby. And you can actually frame that as a conversation to your founder that might be hesitant to give away time for SMEs. So that's one option. Again, 20 minutes, like once every 6 to 8 weeks. Can we do that? Yes or no? Amazing. Also come with the topics. And then you're just like, hey, I need you to riff on like this for 20 minutes. It makes life a lot easier. That's the first thing. Second thing, start a podcast. It's the exact same idea. And instead of having one subject matter expert, we've got most of our shows that we're running on the podcast out of Scrappy ABM are very like individual thought leader led. We have a couple of shows though that are on behalf of a brand, and the brand is massive. There's one company we work with that's like $2 billion. And we have a rotating set of hosts because admittedly, I hate to put it this way, the host is not the person that matters in that context. It's a subject matter expert that is coming in to showcase and to share their expertise. So it's not a personal brand driven show. It's a subject matter expertise with a rotating set of people. So they're very focused on the topic. It's a super easy way that you can actually create more content. And surprise, the exact framing is the same. I need same SMEs 20 minutes every 6 to 8 weeks. And I'm going to interview them. And we're going to also happen to release it on Spotify and Apple and post produce a bunch of content. Last thought, people for whatever reason get really stressed about podcast interviews and they don't want to make time for the like, you just need me for 20 minutes to make a blog. What, like, they just don't make time for it. Host webinars, build a webinar program that's entirely focused around capturing subject matter expertise that can then be repurposed in a variety of ways because people love to join webinars. Just the word webinar, people are like, oh, this feels more fancy. Or other thing that'd be very difficult but could be done is speaking engagements. Get them on other people's webinars or get them on virtual conferences. Like, some of these places are dying for good speakers or for at least knowledgeable people. And if you can get them set up on something else, they're more likely to say yes because they feel honored and you can still post produce the same content.
100%. I do find that now that we're bouncing back from COVID, that in-person events are maybe more interesting than ever.
Yep.
In as much as now that none of us go to an office, it's like one of the rare opportunities that we have to actually be in person with even with our customers, right? I mean, even these big places, it's like the idea, if I were to say I was going to San Francisco and we have 25 customers in the Bay Area and you go, all right, guys, I'm going to swing by the offices. Well, half of them don't even have an office in, you know, at all. And the other half are like, yeah, but I would have to specifically come into the office on a day that I normally would not, just in order to facilitate this meeting. That's a big ask. I don't feel like coming in, like that screws with my life and my schedule and everything else, but it's like these events are big and I think that they're expanding and there's so many more of them. And I think you're right. It's like people go, oh, well, this event's not very big. There's only a couple hundred people going. You're like, yeah, but if you can speak and you've got a deck together for it, and then you get all the recorded content and everything else, it's like, sure, maybe you only generated a couple of leads in that audience, which still is probably worth your time, but it's all that knock-on effect stuff that's just so incredible. And it's to your point, it's like, now I've got video and I've got, you know, written content, and then, you know, I built this into something else and something else and something else. And I think making sure that you can cover those mediums is also such a genius idea. Okay. I don't know that I have I wanted to talk about something else, but I don't want to talk about it as much anymore. because I think you've been so insightful about frameworks and major components. And I think also just this opportunity to talk a bit about how I think ABM has been cordoned off from a lot of smaller organizations is like this big, hard, impossible thing that you can't do. And I just, my parting thought, and I would be curious to your degree of agreement and to get your own parting thought here, but really is just this idea that, you know, ABM isn't optional and it's not out of anybody's reach. It really is the foundation of all B2B marketing, that this framework, maybe has been screwed up a little bit by being given such a specific kind of like functional name, and that we've given people titles that have it in the title. And I think it's really messed up what people think it means and how accessible it is or how mandatory it is in order to grow businesses. And I'm really enthusiastic about your mindset here, that this isn't just available to everyone, but it is the way. For everyone to build a business in B2B. And I would imagine you agree with that, because I think I just basically talked back what it is that you said during the course of the call. But any add-ons or, you know, friction to that?
The only thing I would throw out is, like, ABM is for specific kinds of organizations. And the caveat to add to everything you just said is, like, when done well, it's still I hate to put it in this way, but it is a significant time and financial investment. Even if it's not in the investment financially from a tech perspective, it's still time. Like, you still have to focus, because everything I just outlined is the opposite of this pray and spray approach. Or I'm just going to, like, I'll use myself as an example. I post a lot of content on LinkedIn. I post a lot of podcast episodes, but I only connect with people that I think are potential buyers. Like, my LinkedIn, even though I've got like 20,000 followers, my LinkedIn program is an account-based marketing strategy. And it's taken 4 years to build it. Like, it's, people don't really like to hear that. I've been saying the same thing, doing the same stuff for 4 years. And I just happened to launch a company about it a year ago. Like, this is the same stuff. So the caveat that I would add to that is, because it's such a financial investment, like, you need some specific criteria. So, like, I think you have to have a dedicated sales team in order to truly scale it. I think you have to have clear product market fit. And I will put an asterisk on that here in just a moment. Generally speaking, you need about a 50K ACV. So, like, because the time investment is just intensive. So, like, there's a couple of people that have come to us that are like, yeah, our average contract value is $10,000. I'm like, you can care about people, but, like, you will not get the return that you would like through an ABM program because of the sheer intentionality that's required. Like, we're talking sometimes people, and there are tools that help with this and all that, but, like, my first ABM program was a HubSpot. Like, I did live website reviews to tear down people's websites that submitted a website for review. I did 40 of those. They all took about 45 minutes. And then I put them onto YouTube, and then I embedded that YouTube page onto a dedicated landing page that I then cloned in HubSpot and changed out some of the messages to be more specific to that person. It took 40 hours just for one program to send 40 website reviews. It's an hour per review. And I got really fast at it. Like, I was really good at it, because I was able to do a 30-minute, like, teardown with one take and no editing, because I just got good at it. So, again, all that to say, like, 50K is the ACV. Product market fit needs to be established. Dedicated sales team. Ideally, this is a longer-ish sales cycle. We're talking generally, like, 90 days plus, because you can then build out some really great pipeline acceleration programming. And ideally, there's an expansion component to this as well. The asterisk that I'll put on all of this would just be, there are specific tech companies. And I was looking at some of them today, just for some of the other programs we're running for another client, that are like CRMs for auto dealerships. Like that's really specific. We had a client that had a total addressable market of 500 accounts because they were a compliance software for the utilities space. So like only in the US. So US based utility companies, software for compliance, 500 accounts. So like, if you're that niche, you should only be running ABM because your market's not that big. Like you could, it was funny. We were talking about building out a program. They're like, we could feasibly call every one of our accounts in 6 weeks with one SDR. And I was like,
yeah,
that's wild. We should do that. Like, but all that to say, those were the things. So I agree with everything. Like if you are an organization that has product market fit, ABM is just the right foundation for you to be running a B2B marketing program. If you don't have product market fit, like you got to figure that out. And once you figured it out,
if you don't have product market fit, go work on product.
I mean, that's it.
That's right.
So that would be the asterisk I'd add.
Yeah, I think that's all fair. I think that's all fair. Dude, you are kind and smart and fun. And this was great, dude. This was so great. I'm so glad that you were able to join us on the pod, man. Everybody go check out Scrappy ABM. Follow my man Mason on LinkedIn. You will not be sorry that you did. He's a smart guy.
Hold on. Can I get fireworks? No. Never does it when I want it to. Only when I don't want fireworks. Anyway, Nick, thanks for having me on. Yeah. Great conversation. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Scrappy ABM. If you enjoyed this week's episode, go ahead and give us a follow so that you don't miss a single episode. We drop every single Monday so that you can start your week off right. And if you're looking for additional great content just like this, go check out scrappyabm.com. We're building a library of frameworks, guides, templates, processes, and tools so you have everything that you need to build a low-budget, high-impact, scrappy program. Again, thank you for listening to this episode of Scrappy ABM. This has been your host, Mason Cosby, and we look forward to seeing you in the next one.